Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the Tribune Company that owns the Chicago Tribune and the LA Times, along with much else, declared bankruptcy this week, just a year after new owner Sam Zell took over, with his notable lack of background or interest in newspapers. It sounds like workers will wind up with the short end of the stick, but what does it mean in the bigger picture? Are capitalists losing interest in media? And if so, what do we think about that? We'll talk with media scholar and author Bob McChesney about that story. Also on the show, the fight over card check union organizing was somewhat low-key during the general election, but the issue has become a favorite topic for pundits who are either warning that Obama will lurch to the left or those who hold out the hope that Obama will turn his back on the labor movement. So what is card check and why does it have corporate America and much of corporate media up in arms? We'll find out from labor journalist Steve Early. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
One of the most indestructible and destructive myths in current circulation tells us that workers for the big three Detroit automakers earn, on average, more than $70 an hour in wages and benefits. On December 3rd, the falsehood was repeated on ABC World News when reporter Chris Bury singled out the United Auto Workers. Quote, "The union did not offer to give back the big stuff, pay and benefits that remain a fundamental problem. Ford, Chrysler, and GM pay union workers more than $73 an hour in wages and benefits. Japanese plants here shell out just over $44. For GM, that translates into $1,500 more per car than Toyota has to pay," close quote. Well, Bury's claim is pure management propaganda, and what's worse, propaganda that's been debunked many times over. As Jonathan Cohn of the New Republic pointed out, average wages for workers at Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors were just $28 per hour as of 2007. The fanciful figure, according to Cohn, results from a sleight of hand in which the cost of all employer-provided pay and benefits, including health insurance and pensions for retirees, is figured into the hourly pay of current workers. This anti-worker trope has also been debunked by the Center for Automotive Research, Media Matters, the United Auto Workers itself, and 2 weeks ago on Counterspin by Labor Notes editor Mark Brenner. And as the Wall Street Journal reported, one industry watchdog figured labor costs for the big three are about $260 per car above Toyota's, much less than the $1,500 ABC was touting. Why ABC News, with all its resources, can't tell propaganda from fact is a puzzle. But the answer could have something to do with failing to cast their nets beyond deceptive industry sources.
One of the first tests the media have set for the incoming Obama administration is the Employee Free Choice Act, a measure that would let workers form a union through having a majority sign cards saying they want one. On December 9th, The Washington Post featured an article on the political status of what's called card check. It's been promoted by labor groups and their allies and bitterly opposed by business groups. Hence the headline, "Battle Deepens Over Union Organizing. Labor May Be Key Issue for New Congress." But in the Washington Post, it's not really much of a battle at all, at least judging by who the paper decided to quote. Three critics of the measure are cited: Rick Berman from something called the Center for Union Facts, Katie Packer of something called the Workforce Fairness Institute, and Republican political strategist Mark McKinnon, who the Post would acknowledge days later in a correction should have been identified as also a spokesman for the Workforce Fairness Institute. Weighing in for the other side was one source, Greg Denier of the labor group Change to Win. He was quoted in the second-to-last paragraph of the story. We'll have more on card check later in the show.
Amidst a spike in media interest in the Guantanamo military tribunals, the New York Times ran a curious piece on December 10th under the headline, "Relatives of 9/11 Victims Add a Passionate Layer to Guantanamo Debate." The head-scratching begins with the lead, which suggested that the presence of victims' families meant that, quote, "something unusual was heard here, a vigorous public defense of Guantanamo," close quote. Well, that's an odd idea, since there have always been vigorous defenders of the Guantanamo prison camp. It's a staple of right-wing punditry. The Bush White House has obviously gone to great lengths to defend their military tribunals. The Pentagon has offered PR tours for visiting journalists, and on and on. Well, a few paragraphs later, reporter William Gleyberson expanded on that point, quote, "The routine here has long included officials making their case for the detentions and trials at the Guantanamo Naval Base in muted bureaucraties about fair and open proceedings. They were outmatched by human rights groups and defense lawyers with their inflammatory accusations about torture and secret evidence," close quote. Well, read that again. Guantanamo's defenders have played it cool, maybe too cool, while critics have made inflammatory accusations about torture and secret evidence. The latter, secret evidence, is a feature of the military tribunal, so it's hard to see how that's at all inflammatory. As for torture, well, that's been well documented at Guantanamo and elsewhere. But to say it is so is apparently to make an inflammatory accusation.
Critics have devoted considerable energy to demonstrating that the country's so-called paper of record, the New York Times, has a kind of top-down class bias that colors its view of the world. But sometimes the paper makes that case most vividly outside of the news pages, in the throwaway culture items, like one from the December 10th dining section, in which the paper asked readers to believe, just try and believe, that you can have, said the headline, "Great meals for two, under $100," followed by, for the disbelieving, the parenthetical assertion, "It's possible." Times food writer Frank Bruni called it an experiment for lean times. Such a thing might strike you as economically tone-deaf, but it's hardly a first for the paper. Our archives turned up gems, including a columnist in 1997 explaining that, quote, "the $100-a-bottle wine, once an example of vulgar excess, is now an everyday occurrence," close quote. Well, for some, maybe. And that's the point. These items tell you who the New York Times believes its audience to be, who they think the paper is for. Just something to keep in mind as you look past the ads for luxury cars and diamond watches to find the news.
And finally, the long wait is over. The new host of NBC's Sunday chat show, Meet the Press, will be network correspondent David Gregory. Some press accounts mention Gregory's reputation as a tough questioner based on a few heated exchanges at White House press briefings. But does that really tell us much about David Gregory? Well, consider some other examples. Earlier this year, journalists were once again defending their performance in the run-up to the Iraq War, and Gregory was on board, lashing out at critics, saying on MSNBC, quote, "I think the questions were asked. I think we pushed. I think we prodded. I think we challenged the president," close quote. Gregory complained that media critics, quote, "think that if we did not debate the president, debate the policy in our role as journalists, if we did not stand up and say this is bogus and you're a liar and why are you doing this, that we didn't do our job. And I respectfully disagree. It's not our role," close quote. Well, okay, but part of a journalist's job, we think, involves challenging politicians and not falling for spin and shtick. On that count, Gregory hasn't always performed very well. On October 6th, he seemed surprised that most Americans thought Barack Obama and Joe Biden had won their debates with John McCain and Sarah Palin. Quote, "I think both of these debates have highlighted pretty strong performances by both McCain and Palin. You can argue who won on points, certainly, but in both of those debates, they were strong performances. This polling doesn't bear that out at all," close quote. And the day before that, on Meet the Press, Gregory said of Sarah Palin, quote, "She chose to ignore a lot of the substantive aspects of the debate and speak right to the American people. That's where she's winning. She has a lot of charm, a lot of charisma, and that's working for her," close quote. Gregory's apparent willingness to put his faith in Palin's charm suggests that he can be, well, easily fooled, which might make him the perfect candidate for hosting a Sunday chat show after all.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The Tribune newspaper and TV chain filed for bankruptcy this week. The company that publishes the Chicago Tribune and Los Angeles Times, and has numerous other media holdings as well, had been struggling with debt, much of it taken on when new owner Sam Zell took control last year. Zell used what Business Week magazine called an innovative financing scheme that used Tribune's tax-exempt employee stock ownership plan as the vehicle through which to fund the transaction. action. A lawsuit led by LA Times auto reporter Dan Neal and others suggests that not everyone was too happy with that at the time. But are the Tribune's troubles mainly about Zell, nicknamed the Grave Dancer, and his mismanagement, or do they hold any broader lessons about the newspaper industry or the financial model that governs it? Here to ponder these questions with us is media historian, author, radio host, and co-founder of the group Free Press, Bob McChesney. Welcome back to Counterspin, Bob.
My pleasure, Janine.
Well, Rocky Mountain News columnist Mike Litwin probably speaks for a number of people when he describes his mixed feelings on this. He writes, quote, "Every self-respecting newspaper person that I know would enjoy seeing Zell fall," close quote. After all, this is the guy who didn't know newspapers, didn't like newspapers. He referred to reporters infamously as overhead and said what the industry needed was him to shake things up. You want that guy to fail. But, of course, you can't celebrate because people are getting hurt and newspapers are getting hurt. What is your reaction to this news of the Tribune bankruptcy?
Well, I think it really reduces to the absurd, or it takes to the full logical extent the trends that have been taking place in newspaper ownership for the past two decades. And with the rise of the sort of private equity fund ownership model, trends that are taking place not only in newspapers, but really across media today.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like Zell was the first or the last. He might be especially obnoxious, but this new owner with no background in journalism who thinks media outlets ought to be run like toaster factories, that model's not really being shaken up by this, or is it?
Well, you know, I think what's happening is that this is taking place at such an unusual time in American media history, in American journalism history. You know, had the Zell episode taken place a decade ago, maybe even 5 years ago, then we could just focus on Zell and his machinations and sort of the sleazy moves he's done and what a lousy guy he is, and then everything would return to normalcy. But we're in a moment now where there is no such thing as normalcy in newspaper publishing. Part of the reason why he's filing bankruptcy is that the business model of journalism going forward, the traditional business model, is suffering, and in the midst of an economic deep recession, which everyone anticipates will continue well into the next 12 to 18 months, the prospects of newspaper publishing, as we've understood them, have taken a dramatic turn for the worse. So what we're looking at now with Sam Zell and the Tribune isn't an isolated case. Rather, the concern, are we looking at the future of the newspaper publishing industry in the United States?
Well, let's get into that. I mean, the New York Times, people may have heard, is mortgaging its landmark building to get some emergency funds because they've got several hundred million dollars in debt payments. There are distress sales, including the Rocky Mountain News, McClatchy's Miami Herald. Gannett announced a staff reduction. The Christian Science Monitor is going from daily to weekly. Now, we understand that, of course, newspapers are still making a profit. We don't want to get carried away that things are in the red. But the idea is that they are not providing the returns that folks were used to. Well, what's the lesson here or the takeaway for progressive media critics? I mean, in a certain way, we want Wall Street to lose interest in newspapers as cash cows. Does this current situation do anything at all to push a search for a different financial model?
That's an interesting way to put it. I mean, if in fact, after 25 years of consolidation, privatization, stripping newsrooms for parts, the corporate community's basically gutted journalism and is now ready to abandon it and say, have at it, guys, it's all yours, they're hardly doing us any favors. They've left us a wreck. And I don't think there's any sense that I see right now that there's a commercial model for doing journalism that really makes a whole lot of sense going forward. And I say this, as you put it, as progressive critics, fairness and accuracy in reporting, myself and my own work, you know, we've emphasized how even when there were ample resources to do journalism, the commercial model of professional journalism had deep flaws in a whole range of areas. And I think we have a very important role in sort of clarifying why we're in this moment and where we go forward, because the conventional wisdom we're hearing already from virtually the entirety of the business press and the industry, as well as the Internet's fault. The Internet has taken away classified advertising. It's taken away readers. And in this context, no one wants to pay for a newspaper or a news magazine, and there's no resources for journalism. That is not accurate. The Internet has, if anything, accentuated and speeded up these problems, but it didn't cause them. As listeners to Counterspin are well aware, These problems in journalism date at least to the 1980s when Ben Bagdikian was writing The Media Monopoly. By the early 1990s, we had major newspaper editors and reporters, people like Booth Kimball and John McManus and James Squires, writing about the decline and collapse of professional journalism under corporate pressures. We saw that commercial newspapers were gutting newsrooms and replacing it with sort of consultant-driven drivel. And we always said, look, if you do that, you're going to lose your leadership. And now that's what's exactly taken place. And what I think, Janine, what this gets us to is, what do we do about it? I mean, I don't think we could turn the clock back to have a commercially viable newspaper industry like we had 10 or 15, 20 years ago. Even if we wanted to, we couldn't do that. And I don't think we'd want to. I think we're at a moment now where we've got to say, if we want to have journalism in the society, what sort of policies and institutions are we going to have to put in place to make it possible? Because the one lesson we have right now is the commercial system has abandoned ship. It is not interested in journalism. If we sit back and hope for the market to wave a magic wand, it's going to be a very long wait, and I think we'll probably have disastrous consequences.
Well, it was interesting to see the New York Times actually look at the Tribune story from the workers' perspective and actually use the word workers in their story, Workers Pay for Debacle at the Tribune, which noted that employees had no seat at the table when the board allowed Sam Zell to use their pension plan in part to finance this deal. Now, I remember at one point there were talks that the Tribune might be bought by journalists, by a guild of journalists. Is that maybe a model?
I think that's one of the directions we have to look at and look at very closely. You know, we're going to be facing a situation. We've talked about the Tribune and the LA Times and New York Times in this program. Well, if they've got a cold, smaller newspapers and smaller towns are getting pneumonia. It's not out of the question that in the next year we could actually see communities in this country no longer have daily newspapers that have had them throughout their history. And so we do need to think very creatively and proactively about, as a society, what steps do we need to take to have legitimate daily journalism in communities around this country with, you know, decently paid journalists working in newsrooms, competing with each other so there's not a single voice that rules, and the market won't do it. One of the options we certainly have to consider are ways in which working journalists can buy and take over and manage daily newspapers, especially the distress papers that are in the process of going under, to have policies to make that easier. We're going to have to look at setting up nonprofit cooperative groups or even municipal ownership with elected governance. But if we do want to have local media and local news, and this isn't just print and ink and paper, this is also going to have a website component instantly with it. But if we want journalism, as we traditionally understood it, if it's valuable to us, we are going to have to start thinking creatively and aggressively and imaginatively about policies and subsidies that have been off the table in this country for a century.
We've been speaking with Bob McChesney. He's professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and author of, most recently, Communication Revolution, Critical Junctures and the Future of Media. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
My pleasure, Janine.
As the electoral map turned blue on election night, so did the mood in the Fox News studios. Turning their attention to the future, the assembled pundits agreed on at least one thing. Obama was going to face an early test on something called card check. And to hear the pundits tell it, this was at the top of organized labor's legislative wish list, and thus Obama must reject it if he was to live up to his reputation as an independent. That line became more or less the consensus view in the corporate press as card check became something of a boogeyman for TV commentators and columnists. This might have been somewhat confusing to readers or viewers, though, since the issue played almost no role in the McCain-Obama campaign. So what is the Employee Free Choice Act, and why does it have so many business groups and so many pundits up in arms? Steve Early is a labor journalist and the author of the forthcoming book, Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home. Steve Early, welcome to Counterspin.
Good to be here.
Now, before we get to the media reaction, let's start quickly by explaining card check. The shorthand description can be somewhat misleading. The Washington Post recently put it that opponents have attacked the proposal's intent to eliminate secret ballots in union elections, an idea they say is undemocratic. That's the way I'm reading the coverage and the opposition in general. There's a good system. You vote by ballot. This would get rid of that, and you would check off a card, and suddenly there's a union. What do you make of that kind of shorthand?
Well, that's actually an incorrect misrepresentation of the state of private sector labor law. You know, as an organizer, I've been involved since the mid-1970s with the workings of the National Labor Relations Act, which is supposed to provide workers with a speedy mechanism for demonstrating in a particular workplace that a majority of them want to be represented by a union and sit down and negotiate with their employer about wages, hours, and conditions. That system traditionally involved workers signing union cards, taking them to the federal agency known as the National Labor Relations Board, and petitioning for a secret ballot vote. What's happened in recent years is that employers have fought those petitions, dragged out the process of the vote, delaying these elections for 4 to 6 to 8 weeks, sometimes for months, and then using that time to conduct a highly coercive campaign of intimidation and brainwashing, often involving firing of workers, threats to close the business, leave the country, and so forth. So what unions are proposing, and advocates of workers' rights generally, is a speeded-up system for workers demonstrating majority support for unionization. It would eliminate the two-step process that currently exists of signing cards and then going to an election, and require employers to recognize new unions based on a majority of workers just signing the cards.
Now, there's so little about the employer tactics in the press coverage. You do hear what the corporate world is saying, though, and it's pretty intense. The CEO of Walmart said, "We like driving the car. We're not going to give the steering wheel to anybody but us." The former head of Home Depot said, "Of card check, this is the demise of a civilization." Maybe no surprises there in their political views, but what's your read on the media commentary on card check so far?
Well, it is sufficiently technical, the detail of this, that I think it's easy for people to make mischaracterizations. For example, that the Employee Free Choice Act would take away the right to a secret ballot election. That's not true. If a particular group of workers still wanted to petition the labor board to hold an election, as few as 30% under current law, been in effect for 73 years, can do that. What it does for the first time is require employers to respect the democratic wishes of a majority, as reflected through signed cards, which would then be verified by a neutral third party by checking the cards against a list of employees. It would also speed up the long delays and frustrations currently involved in negotiating first contracts, where today employers resistant to unionization who lose an NLRB representation election then move to Plan B, which is to engage in bad faith bargaining on the first contract, hoping that workers will just give up and that the unionization effort will falter further down the road.
One of the arguments that I've seen, and it's somewhat ironic, is that the economic crisis that we're in and the recession that we've been in makes it just a bad time to talk about this. And you see that as floated as a kind of a policy idea that now's not the good time to be organizing workers.
Well, it's interesting. In 1935, that's exactly what employers said in the midst of the Great Depression when Congress was debating whether or not to pass the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act, which made it federal policy to encourage private collective bargaining as a way of leveling the playing field between workers and their employers and giving workers a tool for improving their wages and hours and working conditions and raising their living standards. And this was seen by the Roosevelt administration and supporters of the Wagner Act as an economic recovery tool. But the employers at that time said, no, it's going to devastate the economy, which is already in depression, and we're hearing echoes of that today.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mark Whitaker, the Washington bureau chief of NBC News, was on the Chris Matthews show recently. He called this a possible sister soldier moment for Barack Obama, meaning the left is pushing for this, and Obama can benefit by pushing back and rejecting card check and thus winning over the center and certainly centrist pundits in the media. It's impossible to say at this point what's going to happen in January or thereafter, but is it a possibility that the noise we heard in support of card check won't come to much in Congress?
Well, I think labor is going to have to mobilize very aggressively to push this to the top of the agenda and to make it part of a broad-based economic recovery package. I think there's going to be a tendency on the part of the administration, as you indicated, to kind of pigeonhole the Employee Free Choice Act, treat it as special interest legislation, as kind of payback for organized labor. The last time Democrats were in power in Washington, during the Clinton administration and the Carter administration, there were failed attempts at labor law reform. and ultimately rather tepid support for it. I think unions and their allies have learned from those experiences and are not going to sit back and rely on so-called friends. They're going to insist that the Democrats, who now have big majorities in both the House and Senate, do what they pledged to do, which is to enact this legislation, which would benefit millions and millions of non-union workers who right now have no voice at work, no way to respond to pay cuts, to the disappearance of their pensions, the health care cost shifting, and all the other workplace problems of the moment.
Now, we look at the debate that's happening, the public debate, which happens, obviously, in the media, and you see a lot of columnists who've decided to take this head on and some editorial boards. The USA Today editorial page identified Karchuk as one of the three things Obama should dump overboard. Are there voices in that editorial debate who are arguing the other side, who are arguing in favor of passing employee free choice?
Well, I think, without getting conspiratorial about it, but your outfit better than anyone else has pointed out the problem of the corporatization of the media. I mean, when we talk about major newspapers and media outlets and their position on this, they are employers too. The union that I worked for many years, Communication Workers, part of its membership is the Newspaper Guild, which represents working journalists at newspapers. We've had many fights, collective bargaining fights, with many of these same newspapers that are now editorializing against the Employee Free Choice Act. So I would say, in general, the Daily Press is not a big fan of unionization. So there's an element of self-interest in their opinions on the subject. In this area, in Massachusetts, we're actually doing a grassroots campaign on behalf of EFCA and taking workers who've been fired in union organizing campaigns around to editorial board meetings at local union newspapers and explaining to the editorial writers and to the reporters covering this campaign what it's like under the employer's preferred system of securing union representation, which is dysfunctional and needs to be reformed.
Steve Early is a labor journalist based in Boston. His book, Embedded with Organized Labor, Journalistic Reflections on the Class War at Home, will be out soon from Monthly Review Press. Steve Early, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.